And ultimately, I'm going to be focusing a lot more on black holes and extra dimensions, or some more exotic flavors of black holes. But I thought I would start off by trying to talk about something a little more pragmatic, which was black holes in our universe. So this is a very nice, if I can figure out how to do this. It's not very easy. So this is a nice little MPEG. It's, as you can tell, it's quite old, because in the top left-hand corner, you've got the years clicking by. So what the astronomers did was actually looked very carefully at the center of our galaxy, the Milky Way, and watched, made sort of, you can see where the observations were, made various plots. Is that moving? Sort of took photos, if you like, of where the stars were. And then by tracking the orbits of the stars, what they could see, so you can see this 10 light days now, how big that is, they could actually see, if you see this one coming in and whipping round, they could see that stars at the center of the galaxy were orbiting pretty fast around an object that was very, very compact. And in fact, the object has a mass of about 4 million solar masses. And so this was the evidence that there was a black hole at the center of our galaxy. Now, I don't want to show all of this one, but... Oh gosh, it's even got sound. Just ignore the... So now you can see they've actually done this for 16 years. So not only are the graphics a lot nicer, but you know, they've done a lot of sort of gee whiz about, you know, filling in artists' impressions. Okay. So you've got to get a little bit of their PR. So let's get back. They'll repeat this. Come on, come on. Second episode. I mean, you know, this is like hip science. Dr. J. Have you ever heard of any being Dr. J? I mean, but it's actually very good. It's worth watching. So what you can see here is not only can you see the stars really sort of walloping around, but you actually are seeing distortions due to gravitational lensing. So it's really quite nice. You're seeing a lot of different features of the strong gravity around the black hole. And so... Yes. What, show the trajectories, please. Okay, never mind. It's going to go on. They love their graphics. So we'll just take it once more through.
Zooming in towards the center.
So what this is really trying to get across is just how compact this object is. So this is the actual thing that they've been doing. And can you see how they're all sort of not just moving, but distorting as they move? That's kind of nice.
Sky, making it the best choice for a detailed study of black holes.
There we go.
So what this team did was that at various points over the past 16 years, they kept taking images of the very central region of the Milky Way. Now, from these images, they were able to...
So I strongly recommend that you do a Google of supermassive black hole at the center of the galaxy. You're going to get a lot of rubbish as well. But... you will also be able to see some of those videos in their completeness. So that's on the ESO website. Yes?
So how much do you send someone to the search for the
atmosphere? Yes. No, it's not atmospheric. I think they know how to do their data, you know, and know how to do their deconvolution. Look, this is not relevant, okay? But You know, that what they're showing there is cleaned up information, you know, as far as, at least as far as one can tell. And so, you know, if you're actually orbiting around something that massive, you will be getting distortions, and things do, you know, you can tell because of the way they're ringing out. So, right, so what I want to do, that's sort of having set up a little bit of PR, what I'd like to do is actually go in and dig in a little further about black holes in our universe. So I want to first of all go back to the Schwarzschild black hole. You've seen this, so you know some, most of this should be familiar. But what I then want to move on, if I want to talk about black holes in our universe, a physically realistic black hole will of course be rotating. So I'll start with Schwarzschild. Then I'll move on to Kerr, which is a rotating black hole, and then I'm going to start talking about black holes with extra dimensions. So this today is relatively down to earth, so to speak. Yes. So what I'd like to start off is by giving an argument that black holes do actually form. I mean, what that little movie showed you was that at the center of the galaxy, there was a very massive, very compact object. But how do we know that isn't some sort of huge neutron star or some sort of very, you know, very large object, but nonetheless not a black hole? In other words, something that doesn't have an event horizon. So if we look at our spherically symmetric equation, remember I derived in general that the function, so remember this b squared was what pre-multiplied the dr squared part of the metric. So this was given in terms of a mass integral. What I called m of r, which was simply taking t naught naught, which is like rho, and integrating it out with the appropriate weighting to give an overall mass. Then if I look at the rr equation, I find a relationship between pressure and the time component of the metric. So which tells me that if I knew exactly how my energy momentum tensor behaved throughout the star, then I'd be able to find my solution. So in order to figure out how an energy momentum tensor behaves, put it over here. So our conservation of energy momentum is simply that the divergence of the energy momentum tensor vanishes . And so all I do is I put in what the connection components are and what the actual values of TAB are. And I'm going to assume that I have an isotropic perfect fluid forming my star. It's just an assumption, but not unreasonable. So what I get in the end is a system of equations which would, in principle, solve for the star if I assume something about my energy momentum tensor. So if I assume, for example, an equation of state or a given profile. So this system of equations has a name. Tolman, Oppenheimer, Volkoff. And those are the equations you have to solve if you want to find the metric around a sort of physical, around and inside a physical gravitating star. So, of course, it's idealized, it's completely static, spherically symmetric, it's made out of a perfect fluid, but it should give at least a good clue about what is going on with the full gravitating system. So one thing we can do, so I'm only going to solve this in one very simple case, is that we can model a star by a simple top hat density profile. So top hat is saying that it's like your top hat, it's zero outside the star and constant inside the star. So this is meant to be the step function. So in other words, it's zero when its argument is negative. So here's our density profile. Our mass of the star is going to be 4/3 pi r cubed times rho naught. And m of r is going to be 4/3 pi coordinate r cubed times the density rho naught. So by choosing a really simple form of rho and making it constant, it means that I can actually integrate up these equations. So I can find the p that's consistent with that rho and find the geometry associated with the star. So if I look at the conservation of energy momentum, then rho is just a constant, so I'm only really solving for r less than r here. Rho is a constant when it's non-zero, and my a primed is given by this relation over here, but I know what m of r is, so what I end up with is the first order differential equation for p. P prime is some function of p. So putting in this M of R up here, you see that I've got this common factor of 4 pi r cubed. And basically, I can pull that out, and I simply end up with 3p plus rho naught from the top. And then on the bottom, r minus 2g m of r is turning out to be this. Here's this 4 pi g r cubed rho naught once I've sort of cross-cancelled all the relevant powers of r. So I'm just going to tell you what the solution is, and you can verify it yourself offline. Okay, so that's why I didn't particularly derive it. It's not a very illuminating function. But what it shows is the principle. In this case, I wanted an analytic solution, so I've chosen something extremely simplistic. A constant density profile is not really what you'd expect. But nonetheless, it allows an analytic solution. And that analytic solution has, in fact, some quite interesting properties. So what, first of all, you notice is that if I go out to the edge of the star, right, I've used boundary conditions here to set the pressure to zero at the edge. So I've said that, you know, because I expect continuity in my space-time, the pressure has to be zero at the edge. And then I can go right into the center of the star and say, well, what's the pressure there? And I find that that's given by this Schwarzschild-looking potential. Oops, it's 1 minus. So, in particular, as you make the star, so if the star is very small, then this bottom line is reasonably large. It's round about minus 2. But as I make the star bigger and bigger, at some point, this bottom line actually vanishes, and it vanishes before the numerator changes sign. So this actually tends to infinity when r is 9/4 of gm. So what this is saying, if you have any sort of, I mean, this is a physical pressure. So the fact that the physical pressure is becoming infinite is telling you that you have a physical singularity. And so this is telling us that if we try and make our star too big, it's going to become singular. Something goes wrong. So our maximum size is really given in terms, I mean, this m is also given in terms of r, because we had the real parameter here was the density. And so our real Rmax is actually given in terms of our choice of density. And therefore, our maximum mass is also given in terms of that choice of density. So what this is telling us, I mean, this was a very simple calculation. I wanted an analytic solution that I could write down, so I made a very simple set of assumptions. Obviously, we do not expect those assumptions to continue to hold as we crank up the central pressure of the star. We wouldn't expect our star to remain a perfect fluid. This is a very classical description. It's not taking into account the quantum properties of matter. Nonetheless, this general result that there's a limit to the mass of a star actually carries over once you start doing real physics inside a star, and it's known as the Chandrasekhar limit. And it's about 1.4 solar masses. Now, of course, this all assumes that there's no, you know, in reality, there are stars that are a lot heavier than that, but those stars are still burning fuel. So there's, you know, they're dynamic. There's still a lot of, a lot of physics going on inside those stars. So this is really referring to the fact what happens if you have some massive object that has no way of counterbalancing any sort of gravitational contraction, so it's used up all its nuclear fuel, what happens to it? And basically, this is saying that if it's too big, it forms a black hole. So that is why people believed or suspected that there were black holes in the universe pretty much from around the time that black holes started to be studied. And sort of people coined the phrase, which was in the 60s. So, you know, well, there was some debate and some arguments about whether there really would be a black hole, but essentially, astrophysicists believed that there were likely to be black holes out there. But in terms of actually observing them, that's another matter. So now let's just think about that a little bit. So one of the things, yep.
So how is it being a black hole solve this problem?
Well, what this is saying is in terms of a regular solution to the Einstein equations, this is saying if you want a regular solution to these Tolman Oppenheimer Volkoff type of equations, right? In other words, general relativity plus matter, no singularity, then you can't get too large. Okay, so if you want one of these static solutions where you've got a limit to the mass of the star.
But what would the black hole change in all of these calculations that we made?
Well, it's a singularity. You've got this coordinate singularity, you get your event horizon. And so, it's basically saying that as you put more and more matter, sort of accrete more and more matter onto some object, its gravity is going to pull it together. And, the basic message is eventually, you can things can become compact, you can push your electrons into the nucleus and form neutrons, so you can have something made up purely of neutrons. And then you've got just Fermi degeneracy pressure. But even with that, if you put too much matter onto the star, or the neutron star, it will eventually just go behind its black hole, its event horizon, and then that forms a black hole. So that's what it means. There's a limit to how big something can be.
Okay. What's the gist of how you can work out what the number is? Like, how is that figured out?
Sorry, which?
What, the 1.4 or something?
Oh, no, I mean, this, there's no way you get that from this, right? This is just what Chandrasekhar did, right?
Right, but I mean, like, when, like, what sort of stuff do you, what are the ingredients of, like, the cookbook?
Well, I don't know, because I haven't read his original paper, but my guess would be that he's looking at the thermodegeneracy pressure, and he's looking at adding more and more matter onto a neutron star, so that would be my guess.
Okay.
I mean, it's used very loosely because it was Chandrasekhar that sort of did these first calculations with something that was more realistic matter. This is more quickly to be able to see what it is. But, you know, you kind of know something about nuclear forces, so I guess, you know, you're just sort of looking at that in competition with gravity as you add more and more matter in. So, you know, I suppose it's also coupling it with this idea that once you're inside the event horizon, which I haven't talked about at all, I don't know if Rob or Malcolm Perry did, but once you're inside the event horizon, all the matter is then forced to actually contract down the central singularity. So there is always a singularity inside the black hole. So this argument here, the only forces that you had were fluid-type forces, right? Because that's all I put in for an energy momentum tensor. But as you know, when you do cosmology, you sort of start off by looking at this type of energy momentum tensor and looking at the evolution of the universe. But that gives you a really good picture. But if you want to start doing more details, you sort of replace your perfect fluid with something a bit more realistic, like an ideal gas or actually some proper Bose-Einstein or Fermi distribution of particles, and then you start seeing in more detail how the interaction between the gravity and the gas or the matter that works. So it's the same sort of thing here. So because we have, or you will have, talked about the event horizon of the black hole being this boundary between things that you can see and things that you can't, and indeed that was why the phrase black hole got coined, the idea that here was a hole in space, you couldn't see anything behind it, so that made it black. So you can't directly see something that doesn't give out any sort of signal. So I'm ignoring Hawking radiation at the moment. So any way you see it is always going to be indirect. And there's sort of essentially three So really that third one is kind of subsumed in some way in the second one. But there's three ways of seeing something that's a hole. Either you see it as this wonderful hole in terms of a blot on your image, but that would really require what you were looking at to have a fairly significant angular size on the sky. So yes, you might get lucky. There's all sorts of nice animations of seeing a black hole going in front of some bright object in the distance, and then you do actually sort of see this thing tracking across. So that would be one way, but you'd have to be lucky. But so in reality, it's one of these two. Now, for an ordinary star, stellar-sized black hole, whilst, first of all, there could be visible objects orbiting it, but they're in a pretty extreme environment. And so it's very unlikely that you're going to see things via tracking orbits of other stars. But this, of course, works beautifully for the black hole at the center of the galaxy, because there you do have stars. There's a lot, the core of the galaxy is somewhat more dense than out here. And so there's lots of things going on. So that sort of was the example that we started with. But the way in practice black holes tend to get observed is by looking at their accretion disks. So usually in astrophysics, you tend to find that you get binary systems. So there's quite often either two stars orbiting each other, or a star and a very large sort of planetary object. So we've got Jupiter, for example. So usually, when a black hole is formed, once a star's come to the end of its life, there is actually some material around it. And that material then gradually gets sucked in to the black hole. And as it does so, it sort of tends to, it's a fairly extreme environment. There's a lot of tidal forces around the black hole. And so this heats up the matter as it falls into the black hole. And then you get a lot of sort of rethermalization. And because your black hole is rotating, you kind of end up with this sort of rather large disk of accreting material that is falling onto the black hole. But as it is falling into the black hole, you could approximate it by going on circular orbits, which gradually decay. And so the matter moves gradually closer and closer to the black hole until it reaches an innermost point beyond which it can't sustain an orbit, and then it gets pulled in. And so this process of gradually moving in before being eaten is an extremely, there's a violent process. There's a lot of radiation, and typically you find that at any particular radius, there's an approximately black body radiation at a characteristic temperature proportional to the radius. And so the highest temperature you see is indicative of this innermost orbit here. So this thing So what people do is look at essentially traces of the temperature of this accretion disk, which is related to the size of this innermost orbit, or inversely related to. Mm-hmm. Well, your matter isn't completely collisionless, right? You've got real matter which is interacting. It's a plasma. You've got a lot of magnetic fields around. So it's very dirty stuff what goes on in the accretion disk. But you can sort of kind of imagine, if you've got this plasma, it's being sucked down a plug hole. It's not just going to go quietly, right? It's going to heat up, and it's going to cause a lot of junk. So what we do when we write down things that are analytic, it makes it all look very clean, and this is far from clean. Yep.
Still have disk-shaped accretion disk.
No, but what I'm going to do first, because the Schwarzschild solution is easy, is I'm going to just look in a bit more detail about some of what this innermost stable orbit is, and then I'll talk about the Kerr solution. Okay. So let's just first of all look at the Schwarzschild solution, so that we can, it's always, because it's so much easier, you can understand the main points by looking at that first before you kind of, put the seatbelt on for Kerr, I suppose. So you've done quite a bit, I gather, about geodesics in the Schwarzschild solution, and these very easy approach to finding geodesics is to use what's known as a Hamilton-Jacobi approach, which is to use conserved quantities. So I'm not sure whether you actually did this. You did. Great. So you know exactly why it works. So if you have a coordinate on which the metric does not depend, so if you have a coordinate the metric is independent of, then this C coordinate here, let me give it a sort of special name, C, no, I don't want to do that. C tilde. then you have a conserved quantity associated to that index. And then you've got a first integral. Which is that if you take what is essentially the norm or the length of the 4 vector, which is telling you about your GD6, so that's just the length of the tangent vector, then this is equal to a constant which you take to be 1 if it's a massive particle and 0 for a null particle like the photon. So this usually enables us to very quickly find out about geodesics. In the case of Schwarzschild and Kerr, what I'm going to do is I'm going to look at equatorial geodesics. So for Schwarzschild, I can always orient my axis such that my geodesic is equatorial. I can't do that for Kerr. So if I now look at this first integral here, then I have that if I, just for simplicity, I'm going to write V of R is 1 minus 2gm on R. Stop writing that down every time. So that's the first integral. Then I'm going to use my conserved quantities to substitute for T dot and phi dot. And then what I find is that I can write things as something that looks like an energy equation. And so geodesics are given simply by particle motion in this potential well, so one particle problem. So I can call this thing an effective potential. So I know what I can get by plotting this V effective of R, I can get qualitative information about geodesics. So, for example, you can see that this V effect of R, if I actually put in what it is, it's going to be K minus 2GMK over R plus H squared over R squared minus 2GMH squared over R cubed. So, yep. Yes, that's the affine parameter along with GD6. So what you see here for this effective potential is you've got an attractive potential. So this is your Newtonian potential. An attractive gravitational part, which you would get in Newtonian gravity. You've got a repulsive centrifugal type of force. And then finally, this last term is the new thing from general relativity. So this is our GR, and then that's attractive. So what you see is that if you're a long way out, you're more or less just doing Newtonian theory. And in Newtonian theory, your sort of centrifugal potential would eventually win out. But with GR, the final word is always gravity, because as R goes down to zero, this is the term that dominates. So you, what this is telling you is that eventually, if you get too close, you fall in. So if we wanted to think about orbits, let's just approximate them by circular orbits. Circular orbits would have R dot and R double dot vanishing. And this is, these are indicated by a turning point in the potential. So a turning point in the potential will be somewhere where you can choose E such that R double dot vanishes. And they'll be stable if V double prime is positive. So the idea there would be if your potential has locally something that looks like a local minimum, your circular orbit is sitting right at the bottom of that, and that's nice and stable. If you perturb it a little, so you give a little bit of energy to the system, delta E, you'll find, it's not quite delta E, but anyway, you'll find that your, what your orbit does is simply oscillate between a minimum and maximum radius, and that's just an elliptical orbit. So these are stable orbits. And what you see is, if you look at the Schwarzschild effective potential, is that gradually, as you sort of vary the parameters, you get, you have a minimum. You know that it has to go down to minus infinity as R goes to zero. And so you have something that looks like this. But as you change the parameters, either the minimum deepens, becomes sort of more solid, or gradually these two turning points move together and it disappears. So let's just look at what's happening there. So if I take the derivative of V and the second derivative, so the first thing that you can see is that if k is zero, right, so this is null orbits, so if I blot that first term out, then I can't actually simultaneously have V effective prime being zero and V double prime being either zero or positive. If V prime is zero, V double prime is negative. So what this is telling us is that for null rays, you can get an orbit, but it's not stable. And that's So there is an orbit, and that's out at r equals 3 gm. So that's the unstable null orbit going around a short, short black hole. So what happens for k equals 1? Then what this innermost stable orbit corresponds to is an orbit of marginal stability. So the idea is you've got these circular orbits where H and R are tuned to give you the energy of the orbit, and out. But as you move closer and closer towards the black hole, this minimum is gradually becoming shallower and shallower in the effect of potential, till eventually it's an inflection point. And if you go too close in, you end up in an unstable orbit, and that's when things get sucked into the black hole. So if I take k equals 1, then and actually look at what each of these being 0 tells me in turn, I can solve for h squared. So these two obviously have to be the same. So that tells me that this is, for Schwarzschild, this innermost stable orbit. So that's sort of a situation where it's very easy to deal with a geodesic equation. We haven't had to work too hard to get a result. And this is saying that, remember, the Schwarzschild radius itself is at 2 gm. And so orbiting matter around a pure Schwarzschild black hole can orbit down to about 3 Schwarzschild radii. Of course, black holes are not static and non-rotating in nature. So it's quite interesting. The Schwarzschild solution came out pretty much practically concurrent with general relativity, but Kerr black holes, trying to remember, I think it was the early 60s before a rotating black hole solution was actually written down. So this is known as the Kerr solution. And the main thing that it does is it adds, or the really new thing that it does is it adds cross terms in the metric. So there's some functions that have been introduced here. So this is what the Kerr solution looks like. It's what's known as an axisymmetric solution. So that means that it has an axis of symmetry, which is, you can think of as being just the polar axis. Phi is an azimuthal angle around this axis of symmetry. T is, of course, time, or a time, as usual. But when you have, just saying that things can depend on two of your four coordinates doesn't, you know, necessarily, it actually allows a much wider class of solutions than, you know, than you might at first think. And so this particular solution is in looking at the phi t space orthogonal to the r theta space, the coordinates on which things depend. This is now pretty much the most general, well, it is the most general, vacuum metric. So it's allowing for a cross term, and we know we can interpret this as angular momentum. And so you notice that with this metric, there is a sense of orientation in time. If I reverse it, time reverse the metric, I have to also change the sign of A. So that's exactly what you would expect, that if your black hole is rotating in one direction, turn the clocks backwards, it's going to rotate in the other direction. And what the price you have to pay of introducing this rotation is that your metric functions become more general now. So the way I've written it was to try and sort of emphasize the similarities as well as the differences. So you see that there's still something that looks like the sine, you know, the sine squared theta d phi piece, but now it's multiplied not just by r squared, but r squared plus a squared. There's also a d phi squared piece coming from here. If you look at the tt piece, it's similar to Schwarzschild, 1 minus 2gm, but then instead of 2gm on r, you've got r on rho squared. So here, again, you've got something which is dependent on this angular momentum, this speed of rotation. And indeed, you see, it's also dependent on theta. So as you go from the North Pole down to the equator, you actually see that this thing goes from being r squared plus a squared down to just r squared. And here you start off with just being dt and then dt minus a d phi. So it is a bit of a, you know, more complicated metric. But once again, you know, you can obviously play the same game looking at the geodesic equation using the Hamilton-Jacobi formulation to actually find conserved quantities and think about integrating up. So what we'll do tomorrow is we'll look at the singularities of this metric. When the Schwarzschild solution would have been introduced, you worry about where there are singularities of the metric. We're very used to the singularities at theta equals naught and pi, so we tend not to worry about those. But other places you can get singularities are when GTT goes to zero, and also where GRR blows up. So there's two, as you can see, there are two options here. GTT goes to zero in a theta-dependent way, but GRR blows up here when delta goes to zero in a non-theta-dependent way. And so there is actually a physical difference between these two surfaces, so we'll talk a bit about that tomorrow, as well as talking about geodesics in Kerr, and then moving on to higher dimensions.